Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On part one of this two-part conversation, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Tommy Schultz, the incoming president and CEO of the American Federation for Children, a national advocacy organization focused on state-level systemic change towards empowering families with options of education choice. The two discuss how choice shaped Schultz's life growing up on a farm in California, priorities he wants to tackle taking the helm at AFC, developing a new group of advocacy leaders that have benefited from choice, and how the pandemic has revealed to many more people the fundamental inequities in our educational systems. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
I'm really excited today to have Tommy Schultz, who is the new president and CEO of the American Federation for Children. So, Tommy, welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
So, Tommy, I know most of our listeners are familiar with AFC, but real quickly, what is the American Federation for Children? What's your mission? What do you guys try to accomplish?
Sure. So I'll start at the end, I guess, where our mission is to empower families, especially lower income families, with the freedom to choose the best K-12 education for their children. In many ways, Step Up is a big part of its development and history and how we got to where we are today. But, about 30 years ago, there was this concerted effort to pass state-level policies that allowed families to go and access a school of choice, which I think is kind of how the moniker school choice came about. And this was largely driven, I think, by philanthropy and then also civil rights activists, state-level lawmakers that said, look, there are some fundamental issues that are holding our kids back in the K-12 system. And one of those is the odd zip code assignment, sort of Frankenstein's monster of a K-12 system that we have. And so for folks that were trying to reform that, I think there was this initial effort to say, hey, look, let's try and reform the public system. They sort of came into the buzzsaw of the kind of massive bureaucracy and entanglements of laws and regulations and special interests. And so there were some folks out there saying, look, we have been generously providing scholarships for children to go to private schools, especially kind of in low-income areas. And I think some of them had the realization that, look, this is great work. We're helping a handful of kids every year, but A, we'll eventually run out of money, and B, we're not making systemic change. So I think that was the real beginning of our organization, and now I'm sort of quickly summarizing what, numerous organizations and numerous individuals were doing, 20, 30 years ago. But it really came together around this notion that we need to pass laws such that these scholarship programs and these new educational opportunities can be codified within the system rather than as sort of this outside effort on the margins, purely in the philanthropy space. And, fast forward 30 years, you have any number of governors passing programs, legislatures creating new opportunities. And I think in recent years, wholly new bits of thought leadership around truly customizing education rather than keeping it sort of domain-based or, within the four walls. And I know you and your team have put a lot of effort into thinking through this and, administering programs that allow families to customize their education. So, that's the long, quick story of AFC and where we came from. And I think our official real start date for the current organizational structure was a little over 10 years ago to where we became the American Federation for Children. We are a 501c4, we have a 501c3 and 527, and that unique infrastructure has allowed us to do a whole number of things that, fully run the gamut from to help families get access to educational opportunities. So that's the quick history of it there.
Well, thank you, Tommy. Let's talk a little about you for a minute. I know you're a California kid, grew up on a ranch, but why don't you tell the story of how you got into the movement personally?
Sure. Well, I didn't know it at the time, but back in, I guess, high school, you could say I was being groomed to get into the school choice movement of sorts, the educational choice movement, to where, my family was a firm believer that they wanted to give their their children access to the best education possible, and they would make sacrifices to do so. While both my parents attended colleges, they have associate's degrees, they also felt, I think, in many ways that, look, access to a great education is something that cannot be taken away from you, and it could be really your ticket out of, a life that maybe, my parents felt that they never had access to. They could get access to a life that they never had access to. And so they were always firm believers in, checking our homework from a very young age, making sure our report cards had as many straight A's as possible. And especially in high school, it came to this decision to where, we're graduating eighth grade, both my sister and I, my parents said, look, we think that there's a few of these private schools that are in Sacramento, about 60 miles away from our farm, that we think that you should go there. And if you can get in, we will make all the sacrifices possible to get you there. And I reflect back on that now because I've actually conducted polling partly based upon my background and how I grew up to say, where we've asked families in nationwide polling, would you be willing to drive your child, 30 miles or 60 miles away to get access to a better school if it was available to you? And there's a near majority that say, yes, we'd be willing to do that. And one of the arguments that you probably hear, Doug, in your line of work, and I've heard it certainly from the opponents, is they concoct this fiction that, hey, a school is too far away and therefore a parent won't be willing or able to get there. But I reflect back onto my experience as a rural kid growing up saying, look, my parents, wholeheartedly believe in giving my sister and me access to a better educational environment, and they were willing to drive 60 miles each way in commuting to get us there. In my background, I saw that, look, I was lucky and blessed that my parents had the financial means and the ability to do that commute and to make that sacrifice, and I am deeply thankful for everything they did there. Coming from that farm background, I learned good ethics in terms of good ethics and work ethic, especially in terms of how to always be the hardest working person possible. But I also looked to my parents as real role models for me and saying, look, they prioritized our education, and I'm deeply grateful for all of their sacrifices because it set me onto a whole different trajectory that I don't think I could have even imagined. And coming into this role and thinking about hearing similar sentiments from so many students that we've been able to help, especially in these lower income communities, where they've said, nearly verbatim things that I just said, my education changed like the course of my family's life. I think I've shared some of that sentiment. I'm certainly in a different vein of coming from a state that didn't have an official school choice program or in any sort of customization option. It really was on the hard work of my parents and their sacrifices. But I think to me, it really gets to the fundamental core of our work, where it shouldn't be necessarily that, hey, only a family who is able to do so has either the financial means or the flexibility within their work schedules to be able to make big sacrifices. I mean, that's fundamentally creating an unfair society in some ways, to where, I think the pandemic now has really exposed a lot of these issues, and it's actually created a whole new conversation that's happening around this that I think you and I and many of these other folks that have been involved in our movement for so long have been saying for decades, but now the pandemic in so many ways has brought a whole lot of other folks into alignment. So to me, my background has led to, where I am today, absolutely, the sacrifices my parents made. And I think too, now in some ways, so many millions of other families are experiencing and getting a bit of a taste of what some of us have been seeing and looking under the hood at for many years.
What are some of the priorities that you want to focus on as a new leader of the organization? By the way, I'm excited to see, from my perspective, it's a new generation, and it's very exciting for me to see a young man in your situation stepping up and taking leadership. So I want to tell you how much I appreciate that and how excited I am about you in this new role. So, but talk to me about what your priorities are and what you hope to tackle as the new CEO and president.
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words. I hope I can live up to your expectations. As I look at AFC's operation, we've been a really successful organization on a whole host of things. And I'm essentially trying to think of ways that we can double down on those strengths that we have. I think partly in kind of how we've structured the organization and its mission. I mean, we've done a really great job of building that into a world-class enterprise. And then two, I think we have amazing people on our team, and we're trying to say, hey, look, how do we empower them even further to do more and better work? How can we create systems and processes that make them, especially in this moment of being totally, you know, in this remote world and in this shifting workplace environment, how do we create ways to get them feeling like they are still collaborating, that they're doing really productive work? And I know your team has thought about this as well. And I think we've got a good roadmap ahead. And I've had a lot of great conversations with, you know, our staff and folks on our senior team and folks on the front lines about what this might look like. And I think ultimately there's a lot of energy, and I feel like there's a lot of momentum as we're heading into this kind of next phase. And I think to your point, actually, you brought up about new and maybe, you know, next generation of leadership. One of my priorities, and it's something that I've been working on with my team in the kind of communications realm here at AFC for the past couple of years, is to elevate the voices of students who have benefited from this. I think we, you know, sure, as education reformers in the kind of professional sense of it, I think we are better served, and I think the movement is better served when we are just highlighting those students. And I think we've constructed this incredible sort of entity within AFC called Voices for Choice, where crossing the threshold of 600 student profiles that we have documented and put onto our website and that we are actively putting out on social media. We are actively using them in kind of creative marketing campaigns, because that's really what this movement is all about. We are called the American Federation for Children for a reason. And to me, as I look across, you know, what does the future hold and what's going to be best, I would love it if one of these amazing students would eventually take my job, right? I hope that I can create a system that actually fosters and enables that, because who better can be a spokesman person for our issue than a student who has directly benefited from it? And so we've even created a kind of elite squadron within the Voices for Choice called our Future Leaders Fellows, where we're taking a number of students each year through a development process of getting them trained up on media relations, getting them trained up on policy, getting them trained up on grassroots advocacy, such that they will become, you know, these super soldiers within the movement in the years to come. So I'm really excited about kind of tripling our investment in time and energy there, alongside any number of, I think, creative other projects that I think we could spend hours and hours upon. But as I look towards the future, those are a few of the things that I'm trying to really wrap my head around and apply a lot of time and energy, because I think, you know, whether it is our personnel and strategy or this kind of very exciting moment of elevating these next, you know, this next generation of leaders, I think those are some of the most important things that I can do within the role.
So I know that you've in the process of moving the headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Dallas, Texas. Talk to me about why you decided to make that move.
As we were in some ways coming into this role, we have the I've had the opportunity to take a fresh look at pretty much everything and ask seemingly dumb questions and ask, you know, what I think get down to first principles of things. And one of the things that I discovered in thinking about, you know, the whole direction of AFC and how we are approaching our work on a day-to-day basis is, you know, look, most, if not nearly all of our investment of time and energy and, you know, resources and capital goes towards efforts at the state level. And, you know, while we have had a headquarters and a base of operations in Washington, D.C. for many reasons, you know, practical and kind of some are kind of historical, we, I think, really are at a time where not only that the pandemic has exposed, hey, folks can live and work and do things from remote, but two, I think, in a way of signaling to the broader movement, to future supporters of ours, you know, look, I think this is the best and clearest case that we can make that we are an organization that is, yes, national in focus, but really state-based. No better way to do that than outside of the confines of the Beltway of Washington, D.C. I think that, too, we are also kind of curious to see, hey, where would be a place that we can kind of plant a flag that is also, I think, in the future going to be a very promising leader in the educational choice space. And we considered a number of locations and kind of weighed the pros and cons of different spots. And I think really all roads sort of led to Texas. So, you know, ultimately, I am so excited to be here in Dallas. I've already had a number of really great conversations and intriguing meetings that I think might lead to big collaborations in the future for the whole movement. And so stay tuned for more of that. But really, it came down to a situation of saying, look, where do we think we will be best positioned to make a greater impact for millions of families across the country who have been, frankly, left out in the cold when it comes to our K through 12 education system, and across any number of metrics, really a lot of our kind of navigational beacons were leading us to Texas. Texas just is a great, kind of has a great basket of good variables that overall will be so helpful to us, not only as an organization and for its mission, but for kind of our team.
You mentioned the pandemic, and I want to go back to that a little bit and talk about how you see the pandemic impacting the movement. You know, we stopped using the term school choice and moved to education choice because so much of the choice now transcends schools. And certainly right. The pandemic has accelerated that and highlighted that. But talk to me about how you see the pandemic impacting the kind of legislation that's going to be passed. Are you going to see a lot more micro school efforts? Are we going to see more ESAs, educational savings accounts? Is there going to be a bigger push in homeschooling, vouchers for homeschooling, tax credits for homeschooling? What's your sense of how the pandemic might impact how you begin to frame legislation in states around the country?
Well, I think this situation from this year has really revealed to many lawmakers that, holy smokes, the stuff that you guys were talking about, you guys being, you know, the professional education reform movement, the stuff you've been talking about really was true, right? That there are fundamental inequities within this system and the way it's constructed, you know, from 200 years ago and up until today, that have really not given, you know, families a level playing field, right? There are pockets of this country that have kind of a network and a system and a pipeline of schools that have been underserving families for generations. And the pandemic, I think, exposed now to millions of more families that thought they were in quote unquote great schools, or they moved to a quote unquote better school district. Even they are starting to realize, because partly they were a little more front and center in how they were seeing what their, you know, what their child was learning, because everybody was generally having to do a Zoom school situation. So some families, we heard a lot of outcry that they were upset about the curriculum or the teaching practices or the way things were handled, you know, alongside kind of the bureaucratic elements that some parents were wondering, you know, gosh, there's a school just down the road from me that is up and running, or they've got their kind of Zoom and digital operations going at a good clip, but our school system is, you know, either throwing its hands in the air or keeps delaying things, isn't being, you know, isn't good at communicating clearly what the priorities are and what the timelines are. So I think for a whole host of families that just sort of assumed in some ways that, oh, things are fine here, really got to see, oh, wow, when a crisis hit, it kind of, all the fissures were fully kind of revealed to us. So in some ways, that foundation has led a lot of governors and a lot of policymakers, I think, at the state level, even some bit at the local level too, to say, hey, we probably need to make some structural changes here. We need to give families more options, in particular with education savings accounts. I think too, there are going to be any number of policies that are going to be potentially really targeted, whether it's like, hey, a catch-up grant, or I know there are discussions of supplemental tutoring things. I think all of these reforms, yes, are in some ways within the realm of educational choice, to where we can fully make the case that education savings accounts are the best way to kind of promote this flexibility and to give families more options. But two, I think I'm curious to see that, you know, once, you know, the vaccines start getting really fully, you know, administered and out there in the public, you know, if this model of education that we have, where let's say 80 to 90 plus percent of families are within a sort of brick and mortar institution, I am curious to see if that holds. I know there's early data from this fall already showing that, you know, at the margins, you know, upwards of 10 plus percentage of families have either disenrolled from their assigned public school in various states, you know, and have gone either into a homeschooling environment or some other environment. I'm curious to see if those trends that were, you know, happening in the past, let's say 90 days, if those do hold, because then to get back to your point about we've stopped using school choice, you know, I sort of in my role here in as the head of our communications operation, I've sort of been hearing that for the past 3 or 4 years. I don't think it's actually officially taken root and people have outright stopped using it. I think partly because school choice is the coin of the realm, right? Where the broader public outside of our, you know, education reform conferences that you and I attend, you know, they may not know what we're talking about if we say educational choice, but school choice has at least had kind of some bit of penetration within the media landscape for the past 20 or so years. And I think too, partly because, hey, I mean, you know, the vast and overwhelming majority of families are actually going to a school. But I think you are right directionally that, yes, we are going in a direction that education might look very, very different going forward. And a final point I want to make on your question about what is, you know, the implications of the pandemic, essentially. You know, I think there are going to be some policy maneuvers here that have to get done within the next year or two, really around the students that were truly left behind. So a haunting statistic that I saw a few weeks ago that came out from Bellwether, which is a nonprofit, and they put out data saying that they've estimated 3 million children haven't had a single day of learning since March, both in person or virtual. I mean, that's harrowing. And you and I know and have seen these statistics. I know Governor Bush had been talking about these statistics for a long time that I think really penetrated the national kind of psyche in some sense. That, look, I mean, if you don't learn to read by third grade or if you don't hit certain benchmarks along kind of a child's educational development, it is very likely they will never get to recoup what they lost in some sense. So to me, when I hear that statistic about, you know, 3 million kids almost, I think entirely from lower income families and, you know, coming from poverty and already challenging backgrounds, I am very worried that if there aren't some significant policy victories here, helping those kids get either back into a good educational environment or at least kind of some form of opportunity to catch up, I am very worried about the implications of what that looks like 10 years out, right? If they are dropping out, if they are getting into bad situations and just never getting access to any sort of education beyond wherever they left off in 2020, to me, I think that's going to haunt our country for generations. I mean, you think about the implications of what that means for kind of our social safety net and how that's going to be strained on in years to come. To me, that is the stuff that tells me, yes, there are some of these glamorous and glitzy things that I think are going to be really exciting opportunities for reforming our system, but it's all, you know, too, in front of some real urgent crises that I think the pandemic has exposed, or at least in some ways the impact of the pandemic has created. And I think we have to get some of those things right, or otherwise we're going to be deeply regretful that we didn't, you know, act quickly and act swiftly and with bold kind of vision and bold policies to actually help these kids. So that's something that's really on the forefront of my mind.
And that 3 million number is significant because it's basically the K-12 population in Florida. So in essence, what you're saying is it would be analogous to the entire K-12 system in Florida shutting down for a year and just, you know, ignoring an entire year of education. That's pretty much what's going on nationally based on those statistics.
Right. Yeah. And it's not like it, and you know this from, and parents know this too, when it's like, hey, kids are gone for a summer, there's a bit of a... Right. Backtracking and something they got to do. And in some ways, it's not like a linear learning loss, right? And this could be exponential where that, like, yeah, if your brain isn't getting some sort of nurturing and kind of stimulation and it's not getting education for a while, I mean, it's sort of exponential, logarithmic, whatever you want to say in terms of the actual loss that these students are facing. And yeah, if the student population of Florida were to suddenly just float off onto an island with no internet and no education, I mean, think of what that would mean if it was suddenly to float back into the system. It's harrowing to me.